they serve. The proposal drew immediate and overwhelming opposition. From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. I'm Stephanie Coachman, and these are your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, April 8th. In Manatee County, a controversial proposal tied to immigration enforcement has been pulled. After strong pushback from the community, County Commissioner Amanda Ballard has withdrawn a measure that would have required nonprofit organizations to verify the immigration status of the people they serve. The proposal drew immediate and overwhelming opposition from nonprofit leaders, advocates, and even fellow commissioners, many raising concerns that it would limit access to essential services, including food assistance, housing support, and health care. During Tuesday's commission meeting, speakers argued the policy could create fear and discourage vulnerable residents from seeking help. Ballard ultimately withdrew the proposal before a formal vote. The issue highlights ongoing tension between local governance and immigration enforcement. From Manatee County policy to development in the heart of Sarasota, the City of Sarasota has issued a construction permit for the redevelopment of the historic Miramar property. The project aims to restore and preserve the aging structure while transforming the site into a mixed-use development with two 18-story luxury condo towers. The historic Miramar building has been decaying for years, with previous redevelopment efforts stalled by legal and logistical challenges. Seaward Development now says construction could begin soon. Now, from local development to a decision that could impact utility bills across the state, the Florida Supreme Court has agreed to review a major rate increase approved for Florida Power and Light customers. The case centers on whether state regulators properly approve higher base rates, which have already led to increased monthly electric bills for millions of Floridians. Consumer advocates argue the hikes place an added burden on residents already dealing with rising costs of living. Meanwhile, FPL maintains the increases are necessary to support infrastructure upgrades and long-term energy reliability. And finally tonight, a moment to honor a life that left a lasting mark right here in our region. In Manatee County, the community is remembering legendary coach Eddie Shannon, who passed away at the age of 104. Shannon was widely known for his decades of dedication to young athletes and local sports. Over the years, he became a mentor, role model, and steady presence for generations of students. Until next time, stay informed, stay grounded, and stay engaged. This has been Stephanie Coachman with your WSLR News headlines.
Good morning. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report right here on your own community radio station, WSLR LP 96.5 FM Sarasota, WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. We're streaming live at WSLR.org and on the WSLR app. And my name is Bob Connors. I'm on every other week. Tom Walker will be back with his version of the Peace and Justice Report next week. And I'm happy to say we have several guests in the studio this morning. And I'm going to let you know who they are and see if I can pronounce their names correctly. Marianne
Kerner.
Spider John Kerner. There was a musician, Spider John Kerner. So when I saw the spelling, I said, I think I can get this right. But I just. And we also have Neil Cowan. And
got that right.
Sally Erb is here, but she's just observing this morning. So, and Dave, Neil Cowan and Mary Ann Kerner are going to talk about the play that's going to be taking place very soon in Venice at the UU Church, Building the Wall.
Correct.
Building the Wall. And so I was very happy to meet a member of the UU Church, not this past weekend, the weekend before, when they had the big conference down there, the Democracy Conference, and had many different people tabling, and they had a keynote speaker, and a lot of people who were into peace and justice were at that get-together a week and a half ago.
It was Catherine Stewart.
Catherine Stewart. I lined Catherine up. Actually, I'm going to ask you for her contact information. I talked to her after her talk.
She's sensational.
Yeah.
She was presently in Warsaw. She gets around.
She's in Warsaw. Yeah. Oh, boy. Okay. All right. Well, Marianne, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? How'd you get involved with the UU Church? How'd you get involved with building the wall? Just a brief overview.
I'll start with my observation of, attendance at the performance of Building the Wall at the Sarasota UUs. How many months ago was that? Anyway, I was so gobsmacked by the message that it was a punchy take on, or actually a humanization of, someone who got sucked into being the head of a detention center. How does an ordinary person move through life and become that kind of person? And it was very powerful, and I wanted very much to bring it down to Venice to get a more a wider viewing. And I hope people will come. It's open to the public, 4:00 on this coming Saturday. Very hard to pick a time where everybody was available. So that is the time, 4:00 this Saturday, be there or be square.
Yeah. Well, tell us, was it well received at the UU Church in Sarasota?
Absolutely. It was, I think, a standing room only.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, hopefully
and
word.
And a very good Q&A afterwards.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully word, a lot of people either want to see it again, or friends and family members who didn't see it will be aware of it. It's happening again in at the UU Church.
Good.
And Neil, you're an actor in the play, right?
Right.
You're the lead actor. There's only two.
There are only two. It's a two-person play, The setting is a prison meeting room in a high security prison, and it's an interview situation between a history professor and this incarcerated man who's been convicted of a heinous crime, and the play revolves around his history and what happened at a prison that he managed, that, like Marianne mentioned, a deportation prison filled with probably undocumented immigrants who are being processed out and deported to other countries.
May I inject that it was written in 2017, long before Minneapolis, et cetera, and it was prescient. It was a view of things to come, at that, as we know.
Right.
So that's why it is very current, even though it was written how many years ago?
Nine years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, I read about the playwright. I'm going to mispronounce his name, Robert Schenkin.
Schenkin. Mm-hmm.
Schenkin. He's a Pulitzer and Tony Award winning playwright, screenwriter, and actor. And so he had quite the background. And he had written this play right after Trump was elected, or right?
No, actually, right before Trump was elected, he responded to the inflammatory dialogue that was coming out of Trump and others around him about illegal immigrants coming over the border, rapists, murderers, drug dealers, and he was incensed about that and sat down and, as he put it, in a 2-week. A white-hot fury, decided to write this play in response to that. And as Marianne said, it's prescient in terms of how we see things now and the invasion of our cities by this ICE force.
So I know that. So did you play the lead role in Into Sarasota UU as
yes.
well?
Yes, I
yeah.
did.
Yeah, I happened to come across you yeah. yesterday. When I have guests that I'm not that familiar with, I said, well, maybe they're on the Internet. You know, maybe I can pull up an interview that they had in the past. And I found you yesterday because you're also do plays and up in Connecticut where you live, what, half the year up there?
True. And I found this play because I was interested in using my theater work as part of the resistance and the resistance to Trump policies. And so I went looking for a political play that would express what I wanted to express, especially around the immigration issue. When I found the play, I read it, and then we did a test. I did a reading in my Connecticut community with friends, and the response was very impressive. They were moved by and viscerally moved by this play. And so I thought, I'll bring it, if possible, to Sarasota. And when I came down here for my season, I approached Maria Rabeo at UUSRQ, and we ended up doing the production here. It was sponsored by the Immigration Justice Coalition of Southwest Florida. And people in the audience, like Marianne, wanted a wider audience. So we've done it one more time in Sarasota, and this will be the third production.
We're on the road.
Yeah, we're on the road. In
right. One more time in Sarasota. So the other time was up in Connecticut? Or?
No, the other time was at United Church of Christ here in Sarasota.
Okay.
I think it's a moving experience, in effect, an emotional experience because you're putting a face on a huge problem. You're an actual person who gets caught up in this system, and it's, as I say, it's powerful, and I hope people will avail themselves of the opportunity. Let me also mention that more information is available at UCOV, UUCOV, Congregation of Venice, .org, which, and the sanctuary is located at 1971 Pinebrook Road in Venice. So I needed to put that in case somebody got lost coming. Anyway, it's quite an amazing experience. So, come along. Here's my voice. Come along. Yep.
Well, it's interesting that it's so timely that Neil, that you brought it to Sarasota. That's a wonderful thing, and that mm-hmm. it's great that Eve, like the person Robert, I can't pronounce his name,
Schenken,
who
yeah.
had written the play. His mindset was similar to yours when he wrote the play. What am I going to do? I have to make a statement.
He has to make it.
I have to make a statement, and you did the exact same thing, bringing it here to Sarasota. I have to mention one guest I've had on the air many times over the last 10, 12 years. If you are not familiar with him, just put in Americans Who Tell the Truth. AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org. So his name is Robert Shetterly. And right after we invaded Iraq, way back in 2003, he was so frustrated. What can I do? What can I do? He was just so upset. But and during his career, he was an artist. So what he decided to do was paint, do portraits of Americans and put them on a website, and he named the website Americans Who Tell the Truth. So I came across him on the Internet, say, I don't know, it was back probably in 2008, 2009. And at that time, there were 50 Americans who he had drawn their portraits. Some were dead, some like Abraham Lincoln, different people in history who made a difference from his perspective, mm-hmm. as far as Americans who have told the truth. And so now, this is 2026 now, and I usually have more than once a year, sometimes twice a year. So at the beginning of 2025, I had him on. We were on the air New Year's Day, 2025, and by then he had painted 270 portraits.
Wow!
It'd gone from 50 to 270, and he's painted portraits of some people who he's never even heard their name before, but he's gotten referrals from other people, and. My only point was concurring with why you brought this to Sarasota, why you wanted to do something, and you found the play. He has found Americans who tell the truth over the last 20 years. He began this right after we invaded Iraq.
Well, this is encouraging because so few people tell the truth these days. How does he find them?
It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. Well, I want you to go on his website.
I will do so.
And you will not be disappointed because it's almost like an encyclopedia of Americans who have told the truth and are telling the truth on a on a daily basis now, like Medea Benjamin with Code Pink, David Rovix, he's a musician, social justice musician. Every day I get an email from him. He has a new song about he had written about some of the issues that we're facing every day. Of course, the last two or three weeks, he's written songs on what's going on in Iran.
Probably and doesn't sleep at night.
He doesn't. I don't think he sleeps at night. I don't know how he can be so prolific every day coming out with a new song. And so that's an example of just a few of the people on the portrait series of Americans who tell the truth. But David, tell us a little bit more about how you happen to be an actor, the lead actor, and how you have been involved with the UU Church, particular here over the years.
I'm a new member of the UU Church, but I have been involved in theater for my whole career, taught theater, and now mostly direct and act. Both in Connecticut and down here. And I just think theater, mostly I work with older adults, people my age, and their willingness to express themselves in a whole new way. So I really, really enjoy that aspect of theater. And I've also been political my whole life. And so when this opportunity arose to do something that I knew I had to do to participate in the resistance, to use my theater background to participate in saying what I needed to say about the illegal and unkind, inhumane aspects of what was going on, especially around immigration, I used that opportunity. And so I researched a play, found this one, and I'd love to spread it to other communities as well. I appreciate Marianne reaching out to me. She's a bulldog for peace and justice, I would say that.
Bulldog. Thank you.
That's a compliment.
I love dogs. That's fine.
Yes, I guess, Marianne, have you been always felt strongly about social justice issues?
I would say so. Yeah.
Yeah. You mind if I say your age?
Go right ahead. I don't care. You get to a certain point.
Well, it's quite a coincidence because I have a really good friend, and about a year ago, she mentioned she had a next door neighbor who was 92 years old, and she said, she is so on top of everything that's going on. She loves to go over there and spend a half hour, but it usually goes into an hour whenever she visits her because she just can't get enough of her neighbor who's 92 years old.
And 92, it's just, she's a baby. I'm 93.
You're 93. Yeah. So I was just trying to draw an analogy.
You draw, okay. Yeah, consider it drawn.
Yeah. So 93. And, you've seen a lot over the years.
I have seen a lot, and I am just appalled about what I'm seeing right now, as we all. Maybe we aren't all, obviously.
There's been nothing like it.
Nothing like it
in my lifetime. Yeah. I'm 79 myself.
Oh, you're so a child.
I've seen, I have to say that when I really got involved in the peace and justice movement, it was right between Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, let's start with saying I was very active in SANE. Nobody even remembers that. I can't even remember that. Now you know I'm 93. Can't remember the acronym, but it's nuclear, against nuclear proliferation. And that was in early 70s,
right.
late 60s.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, all the environmental movement was huge in the 70s. Nobody listened. But anyway, that's life. And it goes on, and it must go on, and you must come see this play, Building the Wall, Saturday. I have to think of the month.
It's the 11th.
April.
April 11th.
At 4 p.m. So come along, please. I think it has so much meat to this reading, basically, this play, which is a reading. And it's open to everyone, anyone. So
it's a 90-minute conversation.
90-minute, no intermission, conversation, intense. Very intense piece, and we'll follow it with a Q&A,
right?
Because it's the kind of piece that raises a lot of emotion, it raises a lot of thoughts, questions, and discussion.
Yes.
So, do you have any thoughts on the wall? It was going to be built during Trump's first administration.
And Mexico is going to be paying for it.
And Mexico is going to be paying for it, like so many other things that he says that isn't just right. he makes them up. But where are we with the wall now? Do you know? It was.
Construction, so many things have intervened.
Construction stopped. I know that much. And then,
well, I've never said this before to you, Neil, or anyone, but I think the play is misnamed. It's not about building the wall. It's about deportation.
Right.
And how cruel. And how a man can participate it just by dint of the promotions, et cetera. And it was just every man who became this, basically, a monster.
Don't give away too much.
Okay.
So this was.
Well,
this,
I'm just trying to pique their interest.
There's a metaphor in the play of an avalanche. And one of the characters says, well, it starts with a stone or a bunch of snow, and eventually it takes over and builds. And that's what happened in this to this particular character, and that's what happened in this situation. And so this metaphor plays out. But the question about responsibility, who's accountable? Are we as individuals, are we as citizens, are we accountable in any way, and is there a responsibility to step forward, to speak out? And that's what comes out in the play about the situation. I won't say any more about that.
Well, we're paying our taxes, are going to these huge amounts of money being spent on these prisons. So we are involved whether we want to or not.
Oh, yes.
But you didn't get to the wall. Why is it named Building the Wall?
I can't know what Shankin was thinking in terms of his choice of title. Maybe there's more to it than the physical wall. Maybe there's a wall between the character and his own integrity or responsibility.
That's good.
But I don't know that. I'm making that up.
Yeah. Well, it's not just the wall to Mexico. It's, as you say, a wall between human beings, between humanity and inhumanity. And
right.
Just where they converge and, where again, who takes responsibility.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, I mean, what's going on now, I mean, before Iran, I mean, this is as bad as it can get. You know, what Trump came out and said the last couple of days, it's just mind-boggling. And, it's time for Congress to act one way or another. I mean,
they have to have their Easter fun.
What do you call it?
Easter fun, and then they'll come back to work.
Maybe. Oh, Easter fun. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, it's just the thought goes through my mind. I mean, one person should not have unlimited power to do whatever they want and be the president of the United States. And then I know the Supreme Court came out with a decision, I don't know when it was, a couple of years ago, that kind of gave the power, he gave even more power
do
to the president.
Do whatever you want. Yeah.
Do whatever you want. It's okay. I mean, it's nonsensical. It's nonsensical.
Well, we're all affected, and I think seeing this play reading is important, even though we may all be on the same page. You know, they say you're preaching to the choir. Well, the choir needs to be rehearsed, and people have to become involved in one way or the other, whether it's helping immigrants or trying to get the laws changed, which is uphill, but got to keep working. And this play stimulates that kind of, oh, my God, I didn't quite realize how anyone could become that person. He just started as a nobody, basic, or not every man, or whatever you want to say.
You're talking about in the play
in
or
the
president?
No, we're not on the president. We're okay. Talking about the play, because
yes.
That's what we're talking about
yes.
here.
Yes.
We want to get people to come to the play.
So. How did he get...
What was his evolution? How
right.
did he? He's a human being too,
right?
You know, so it's fascinating.
Yes, yes. Well, I really appreciate you coming in and letting the listeners know. We have a lot of supporters between here and Venice. Even if they have to pick us up on the internet or on the app, they can pull up the app and hear us there.
What is that? WSLR dot?
On the internet, it's WSLR.org.
Okay.
And this conversation we're having today will be on the website at 10 a.m. after this show ends. You just go to WSLR.org and click on the archive, and scroll down, but it'll be the first show. Mm-hmm. The Peace and Justice Report. So
great.
You can have anyone listen to it or send it off to people you know so that they're aware of the fact that the play is this coming Saturday at 4 p.m.
Refreshments
at the UU Church?
Yes.
In Venice,
right.
Pinebrook and Edmondson.
Okay, Pinebrook and Edmonton. Very good.
Yep. So we as a congregation are very much looking forward to Neil and Peg
Anson.
To coming down and experiencing this. It's an experience.
No,
it's not just theater, which is it is.
Right.
But it makes you think.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Our pleasure.
All three of you for coming in today. Neil and Mary Ann and Sally as well from the UU Church.
Thanks for the opportunity to let listeners know about this play.
And I'm going to play a song now in preparation for my second guest. And it's an older song from the 1970s, Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And let's make sure this comes through loud and clear. I'm going to turn us off and... course, that was Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, Ohio. And I'd like to mention that the 2026 Giving Challenge is happening April 15th through the 16th, a 24-hour giving event from noon to noon, supporting nonprofits across our region. At WSLR and Fogartyville, we're turning it into something special with 24 hours of live programming, performances, and community events. And everyone is invited to participate. We're calling it the Be the One-a-thon. During that 24-hour window, donations between $25 and $100 will be matched, so your gift goes even further. Right now, we're building toward that moment. We're asking listeners to commit to being part of it by making a pledge to give when the challenge begins. If you believe in independent media and community voices, be the one for WSLR and Fogartyville. And I have a special guest in the studio today. That's the reason I played Ohio. Actually, the name of the guests, it's Sandra. Do you go by Sandra or Sandy?
Well, Sandra, because people are always misspelling my name.
Let me put you on, because I don't have the microphone on, so okay. You can have a chance to repeat that. Go ahead, Sandra.
Well, so Sandra, because people are always misspelling my name, so better to stick with that.
Yes, yes, yes. And, I happen to play Ohio. I know you've written a couple of books. You've written 18 books, but I did pull up a piece that you had written, and it was 50 years after the Kent State shootings, and the community comes together to make sure the lessons stick. So, as people will remember, and on May 4th, 1970,
yes,
four students were killed and nine others injured when the National Guard opened fire during a protest against the Vietnam War on May 4th, 1970. And the piece that I had found on the internet was a piece that you had written 50 years later. Now it's 56 years later.
Yeah, so, isn't it a shame? it's a shame.
Did you go to a college? Did I read that you went to a nearby college? You didn't go to Kent State?
No, I went to Miami of Ohio.
Right.
I went to Miami of Ohio, and we had our own little protest. And I was part of it. We had two. We actually had something called the flush-in, where we flushed all the toilets in the campus and drained the water tank. And, of course, as an adult, I see the ramifications of it. But as a 19-year-old student, it was revolution for the hell of it. You don't want to forget that the revolution, any revolution, always has humor, and you have to go with it.
Right.
And the other thing that was much more serious was the April 15th takeover of Rowan Hall. And like I said, I was a freshman. I can talk a little bit about my experiences with that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I wrote an essay, but I'm not going to read it here, but about it. But I was 18, and I grew up in a conservative family. You know, my father was an eye doctor, and he was very conservative. And in Ohio, we had this little town called Yellow Springs, and my father would say, "Don't go to Yellow Springs. That's where all those damn hippies are." And of course, I went every chance I could get. So, but when I was a freshman, the upheaval, the major upheaval was the year 1969, 1970. And that was the year Mike was 18. And I was really torn between the value of my parents, which I love my parents, and I didn't want them to upset me, and the value of my peers. And it was a big conflict for me. So I was kind of waffling between all that. So when the student protest happened, the takeover, which is all about ROTC, you realize all about these have an underlying theme, and it's about ROTC. I didn't even know where the ROTC building was. I had to follow the students. And at the last minute, I decided not to get arrested because it was building up, and I thought, oh, I can't, Stood outside the building. I actually got tear gassed. If it hadn't been for one of my friends pulling me out of the way, I would have gotten hurt. But my boyfriend at the time and what later became his girlfriend were both arrested. And I always felt guilty that I didn't get arrested. And it was always like, I remember one of my then boyfriend's roommate saying, well, President Shriver is a marshmallow. That was I mean, just the stuff that went on. But, you know, what happened later, you know, when I was in college and also when I got out of college really made me realize I wanted to understand why. Why was I torn? What was exactly going on? And that became the genesis of my first novel, The Pipe Dreamers, which is about set in a college like Miami. But it really pretty much covers what happened at Kent State. I try to encompass everything. And then it informed my second book, Where Have All the Flower Children Gone, which was published a few years later. Pipe Dreamers was republished in 2020 in honor of the Kent State events. Where Have All the Flower Children Gone also addresses the other person, my first boyfriend's girlfriend, who became his girlfriend. She was arrested. Her name was Myra Aronson, and she died in 9/11. So that was, she was on flight 11.
Now, wait, Where Have All the Flowers Gone?
Where Have All the Flower Children Gone?
Now, that is, you write fiction in general.
But both.
Both. I know you wrote a book on, before we finish today, before you leave, we'll have to mention you've written a book. You moved to Sarasota 6 years ago.
Right.
And you wrote a book about the Ringling. So
we're
going to allow a few minutes for that at the end. But this is a nonfiction, right?
This is nonfiction, and this is fiction.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about both books. I mean, I think I read that The Pipe Dreamers came out in 2001.
Yes, the first time, yes.
And it just was reissued in 2019.
2020.
So, yeah. So tell us a little bit about how you happened to sit down and write the book. how we happened to have it reissued recently.
This is a personal journey. This is me trying to figure out what happened to me in college. And it ended up, you know, when I first wrote the book, I was newly married, and I wrote the first 50, first, I sat down with my now ex-husband's typewriter. I borrowed a typewriter from his business, and I typed out the first 50 pages of it. I couldn't even watch him read it because I was just starting out. I was like in my late 20s. And I came back. I said, because I said, what did you think? I thought I was going to be the next Judith Guest. I thought I was going to have the next bestseller. I was waiting for the movie deal to come. He looked at me and he said, it sucks. But he was right. He was right. He didn't have to be so verbal about it. He was right. It was not great. I sent it around. Nobody wanted it. And then I kind of realized, well, maybe if I learn to walk, I can run with this book. So I started learning about journalism, and I started doing feature writing, and I started doing nonfiction articles about the Vietnam protests in Ohio. And because of that, I was exposed to administrators, National Guard, people that didn't necessarily see the world the same way I did. And because of that, that became the genesis of the events of 1969-1970. For the Pipe Dreamers. That became the genesis of this book. And because I was raising a family and I was trying to launch a journalism, a nonfiction career, this book took me 25 years to write. And back then, in the late 1990s, early 2000s, it was not everybody could publish a book. It was really hard to get published. So I went to a publisher's marketplace, an international thing in Chicago. And I went to every single booth there and tried to sell this book because I had a publisher and it fell through, and I had an agent, and she said, just print up a little few copies. And anyway, long story short, I got it out there, and then I found a publisher, somebody I met at the bus stop while I was waiting for the shuttle for the airport. And that was a company that published it in 2001. They went under because of 9/11. Yeah. And the book was published right around 9/11. And you know what that did? I mean, nobody was in the mood to hear about the protests. So then this, like you said, I think this was published in 2019, come to think of it. And this one, when this came out, my other publisher, who I've done other books for, he's, you know, we were all excited about it. And then COVID happened. So, we're persisting despite. Yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, the subject matter is something that I would think, especially what's going on now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with all the college demonstrations back a year ago or a year and a half ago relating to Israel and Palestine and what transpired then.
Yeah, I mean, and not only that, but everyone is protesting. People my age are hitting the streets. You know, I mean, when I saw you at the Venice Book Fair, I was on my way and there, I was delayed by the protest, and I saw some guy, you know, it's kind of our age, had a T-shirt on. He said, "I love America." I started crying. I thought, you can't cry. You have to do a book fair. Because it really, you know, people are the passion that we had in the 60s is kind of being due to these unfortunate events that are going on now, the passion that we had in the 60s has been rekindled, I think. So,
well, let's also talk about your other book. The other book, and Where Have All the Flower Children Gone? And you had interviewed several people for that book.
Yes, I did. This book was published by, the first book was published by Hydra, which is kind of an independent publisher. This book, Flower Children book, was published by University Press of Mississippi. And it took me quite a long time to write it because I think the other Iraq war was taking place. Well, anyway, there was a lot of things going on. I think it was the Iraq war. I'm not sure. I think it was Iraq and Iran.
Well, Iraq went on for a long time.
Yeah.
2003.
Yeah.
To
Iran was a more recent one.
Yes.
Iraq is now again.
Yeah.
But Iraq, it was the other one that took place in the 2000s. And so there was a lot of discussion about that. And one of my chapters is about Vietnam and Iraq. I went to Washington, D.C. I interviewed conservatives. And now, you know, before 9/11, I think I went before 9/11, it would not allow me in. But I went into Congress. I talked to all kinds of people. I talked to Chuck Hagel.
Well, yeah. Interestingly enough, I saw that you had talked to Chuck Hagel, and I did go on, and I had a Wikipedia. I don't think I've ever seen anyone have so much coverage on Wikipedia as Chuck Hagel.
Yeah, he's something else.
I was amazed.
He's an amazing
yeah,
person.
Tell us about that interview with Chuck Hagel and how.
Well, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
But how did it even come about?
Because he had a twin brother, and Chuck is a more conservative one, I believe. And his brother, whose name escapes me because he had a brother. I was interviewing him for this book, and somebody told me about him because of the various, you know.
How'd you happen to be interviewing his brother?
Through a referral. Yeah, a referral. I can look it up because it's been a while. You asked me a question. John Hagel. No, Tom Hagel is his name. Let's see. And Tom, we're from Dayton, I think. Tom is a Daytonian, too. And somebody told me about him, that he is a lawyer, and he's, you know, more of a Democrat-type person. And he fought in Vietnam. I think he and his brother fought in Vietnam. I'm not sure. This was a while ago, so I'd have to look this up.
Oh.
But, and they were brothers I don't know if they're brothers or twin brothers. It was a long, like I said, it's been long time since I talked to this guy, but I interviewed Arlo Guthrie too, and
well,
I interviewed quite a few.
Why don't you tell us about any of those, if you can remember any?
I got it. I had to find it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Tom is the younger of the two Hagel brothers. He's a law professor at University of Dayton, and he's a judge. And they were both on opposite sides of the war. Chuck, as we know, worked in the Obama administration, and he was also a war hero, and was a senator from Nebraska. And actually, he's a personal friend of mine. Not really, but I've spoken to him on numerous occasions.
You're talking about
Chuck, yeah. Chuck. Both of the Hagel brothers are wonderful.
Oh,
they're really
great.
They're both very different, but they're wonderful. Arlo Guthrie, I've met many times. I interviewed him for this book, and he talked about, you know, he came from a long line of so-called lefties, and but he was, he wrote, as we all know, Alice's Restaurant. And he was also, kind of the center of the war protest movement. I used to follow him on Facebook, but I know he moved away from where he lived and he retired. But I haven't seen much of him. I don't know what happened to him. But I think he essentially retired. But I just, I interviewed a lot of professors, former National Guards. I talked to people that I went to Toronto to interview people and the people who left you know,
left the country.
Yeah, the country.
Expatriate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this book, Where Have All the Flower Children Gone? And you interviewed so many people. Is it really the background on your interviews, what the interview entailed or what they had to say? Or tell us specifically about that in terms of interviewing the people you interviewed and how they felt about the war.
Right. They all had, you know, very different opinions. I actually told it in their words.
Right. Sure. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I told it in their words. I interviewed people that I was friends with. Here's a woman that I went to college with at Miami who passed away from cancer. Some of them have passed away. But these are people, I interviewed people I went to college with. I interviewed people who were instrumental, who were policymakers during the, you know, Vietnam versus Iraq. I interviewed people who were expatriates who moved to Toronto. And of course, and they didn't come back. They were allowed to come back, but they didn't come back. I interviewed the people that were very conservative. I went to D.C. and interviewed people. And there may be some familiar names. And my life has been, I've come across a lot of interesting people in my life, I will say. But I went to interview people from that. And I interviewed like Alan Bach, who's a libertarian. Some of these you may not know, like, you know, Ronald Deere, who's, you know, conservative. Some of them aren't active anymore. But they had all differing opinions, and they had all differing perceptions.
Did any of the people you interviewed feel that it was worth spending all that money, all that time, all those lives in Vietnam?
Not too many.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
Yeah.
Because I don't hear much.
They thought, you know, the conservatives were more or less, well, we were the young conservatives, we followed Reagan, we believed in the United States, you know, that stuff. Then it comes right down to it. Well, did you go to war? Did you fight in the war? Well, not really. I was this and this and this. But most of them were intelligent people. You know, they were intelligent people. They were nice. I enjoyed talking to them. It was interesting to hear what they said. None of them felt that it was fair that these young men lost their lives. They all felt badly about that. A lot of them, even today, and these are other people that were fought in the war, are incensed by the way that veterans were treated when they came back to the United States, you know, calling them baby killers. And somebody asked me, well, why is that? I said, well, all you have to do is turn on the news today and see what people think of the immigrants. They're not human. They're other. Because they're other, they can't be us. I mean, it's very simple. Go back to World War II. Go back farther than that. It's the same old sad story. You look back on it. Oh, my God, how could we have treated our veterans that way? Well, you know, maybe you got to think about that. You know, when you're talking about something else, I'm just saying.
unfortunately, it's a tragedy.
It really is a tragedy.
And the way the Iraq, Afghanistan veterans, so many are homeless, so many Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan veterans have committed suicide. Why is it? Because they don't get the help they need when they come back, the guidance, the training. They don't get a home to live in. They don't get a job. And it's all, it's tragic. And now, what's going on now is just tops everything, you know, as far as the way Trump talks in relationship. Well, there may be a lot of people who might get killed, you know. Of course, he never went to Vietnam, you know. all these people can speak about what we should be doing, and have, as they say, it's okay for other people's children to go to war, but not mine.
Yeah.
So, but it's impressive that you're such a prolific writer. 18 books.
Yeah.
18 books, and you moved to Sarasota a couple of years ago,
yeah.
And immediately you got into writing a book about
the ringling. Yeah, I know, and I enjoyed that. I do quite a bit of work on that. So.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
That book. Well, I always like to, you know, in my more recent writings, because I had a tragedy myself. I lost my son to addiction. He was in the 2005, he was stateside. So I think in my more recent years, I've tried to turn to humor and things that make people smile, because there's enough sadness in the world as it is. And so the Ringling book was kind of like, I moved to Sarasota and I was always interested in, I love museums and I love Ringling and all that stuff. And I moved to Sarasota and I thought, gee, maybe I could do it, you know. It caught my attention. And there was really nothing written about it that had quite the approach that I did, because I take a unique approach. My book, unlike the other books, has a history of Sarasota, not just the people who established what street and what building, but the natives, the Bucks, the crackers, so to speak, they call the crackers. I don't know if that's politically correct or not, but that's what they call them. And I wanted to explore that. And then what caused John Ringling and his family to move to Sarasota? That's the second part of the book, is the story behind the Ringlings, okay, and why they moved here. And the third is the development of the museum and where Sarasota is today. I mean, Sarasota is very unique. It's a very unique place. And that's why I fell in love with it. So that's why I wrote the book. And so, you know, like I said, I try to turn to humor, because it's a better way to do it. Newest book that I have, I will tell you, I don't know if you saw it on my website or not, but I just completed my first fiction, a mystery satire. It's about the villages. It's a satire on the villages. It's called Doing Hard Time in Geezerville. That's the title.
Doing a
hard time in Geezerville.
Geezerville.
And I can say that because I am that demographic. So you can't throw tomatoes at me for that, because yeah. I'm calling myself one.
Yeah.
So it's done, and I'm going to try to go to Thriller Fest in New York and sell it to agents and editors. And that's what I'm doing now. So.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that book. How did you come to write that?
Well, it's interesting. I wanted to talk a little bit more about the Pipe Dreamers, because it is autobiographical, and it is a love story interwoven with the history, that events of the year 1969-1970. This book and the other book I wrote, Country Club Wise, which is, again, Women, Money, and Homeless Animals in New Albany, Ohio, that one was optioned for television. But those two novels were essentially about stuff that happened to me. This book did not happen to me.
Right.
This book, I started with an idea of a character loosely based on somebody I met on a cruise many years ago. And she was dating a rock star. She was dating a guitarist in a famous band, which I don't want to say which one it is. And I thought, oh, wouldn't she make a fantastic character in a novel? You know, so much you meet people like that. And then in 2008, my friends and I went to the villages on vacation. My one friend said, let's go to the villages. Her friend gave her a condo so we could go there in February. And so we all piled into a car. I was in my mid-50s then, I think. And we all piled into a car. We drove to the villages. I had no idea what it was. Yeah. I thought, what the heck is this? What is this place? All these white Republicans, I hate to say that, nothing wrong with them, but white people. I mean, there was not a black face anywhere, not black, not Indian, not Asian, nothing. You know, I'm like, what is this? All these people are drinking and singing and running around and golf. What is this place? I've died and gone to hell, or at least Disneyland. I mean, you know, seriously, I mean, that was my reaction. So we were talking, my friends and I, so I should write a book about this place and call it Doing, because they kind of felt the same way I did. Because people either love or hate the villages. But if you're going to, you know, anyway. So I was telling them about this. I love to do a satire on it. I didn't know what I was going to do. So I started working on, so I moved to Sarasota. I thought about the book. And I was going to work on a memoir about my son who had passed away. And I thought, it was the middle of COVID. I thought, there's so much sadness. Let me just see what I can do with this book. So I sat down with this basic idea of my main this person, a murder, and I ran with it. And I came up with this idea of this character who was injured in an accident. Her boyfriend broke up with her, and her uncle died, and she inherited a village, a villa in the villages, and she moves down there. She had to retire. She hates it. And then she gets embroiled what becomes known as, pardon my French, the penis murder. So that's what they call it. And so, and then she meets a guy who's a newspaper publisher who's doing an article on it. And he's like one of the few black people in the villages. He's a lawyer. He's very wealthy. He's a widower. And he interviews her. And this is where this is the genesis of this book and how they solve the murder and how she sorts her life is the genesis of this book.
Wow.
And, yeah, I know. Well, it's a long way from this. I'll tell you, a long way from writing about the 60s.
Unfortunately, Sandra, we only have 2 minutes left.
Okay.
So let the listeners know your website.
Sure. It's www.sandragurvis.com. S-A-N-D-R-A-G-U-R-V-I-S, my name, .com.
And the great thing about your website is it has so much more in addition to all the books you've written. There's a little bit about
It has also the book. I'm going to a bunch of book fairs this April. I'll be at the Tarpon Springs. It's the biggest one. That's the closest one. So it has all my book fairs. It has all my talks and all my articles and anything else about my work that you might want to know. So.
Well, I really appreciate you coming in. I'm really happy I met you a week and a half ago.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I was at the conference. The radio station had a table at the conference introducing people to the station and what's going on there. And I left. I was finished with my shift. And I see all these tents behind the senior center.
Oh, cool.
And I thought it was a craft fair. And it turned out to be a book fair. And it was great. I think I got 3 or 4 or 5 more guests from that.
Oh, that's
book
great.
Fair.
That's great.
And it was a pleasure. I said book fairs are where I should go.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where you'll find all the interesting ideas. You didn't know about the Venice Book Fair? Wow, it's kind of been around for a long time.
Yeah.
It's been around for many years.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good one.
I'll remember that for next year. And I'll stay in contact through other fairs by going on your website.
Yeah, there you go. It's a whole wealth of them.
Well, I'd like to thank you for listening to the Peace and Justice Report today. Thank you, Sandra, for coming in. And I want to make sure I'll be back next Wednesday. During the beginning of the 24-hour giving challenge, and I'll look forward to talking to you then. I'll be here